Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Discover More,
where we strive to discover more through intentional dialogues. My name is Benoit.
And my name is Aiden. This podcast will serve as a space to exchange ideas from the collective experience. Welcome to our show, Nick. How's it going, man?
Doing well. Really excited to be here.
Absolutely. Glad to have you here. Do you think you could start the audience off and introduce yourself?
Sure. So my name is Nick Shaker. I'm from Westchester, Pennsylvania. It's a small town outside of Philadelphia. Went to Penn State, studied finance, and graduated in 2016. I was lucky enough to spend a few years in New York working on Wall Street, and now I'm working on my own small marketing and branding startup. So that's a little bit about me. I met Aiden at Penn State my freshman year. We lived in the same dorm, and we found out that we live pretty close to each other back at home. So we've just been buds ever since, and I'm pretty excited to be here.
Absolutely, man. It's happy to have you. It's wild how, you know, just one dorm down can make such a difference in someone that you grew up 10 miles away from. So we're really excited to get into, you know, your Penn State experience, your Wall Street experience, and kind of how your journey's progressed throughout the years. Do you think you could tell us a little bit about high school? Like, what was your kind of childhood upbringing kind of like?
Sure. Yeah, that's an interesting question. So like I said, I grew up in kind of a small town outside of Philly. My parents immigrated here from India, I think something like 30 years ago. And so they were both engineers. And I have an older sibling. He's 4 years older than me. Mm-hmm. So I was lucky enough that he kind of blazed a trail for me. He picked up playing music at a pretty young age. So he played the drums, I played the drums. Every video game he loved to play, I loved to play. Every time he would play roller hockey in a cul-de-sac, you know, in our neighborhood, I wanted to be there. And so our parents, and just kind of by virtue of my brother's passions, what my brother and I ended up doing were a lot of like outdoor activities. We went skiing a lot. We loved water sports. We were just a pretty active family. Mm-hmm. And so it was nice. It was just like a small town upbringing.
Absolutely.
But
how did a small town upbringing then change when you went to Penn State?
Yeah, that was a big shift because, I guess it was a big shift, but in some ways it was still the same. Of course, Penn State's a big school; it's 45,000 undergrads, and so mm-hmm. I tried to maintain a little bit more casual lifestyle at Penn State in terms of my friends. Mm-hmm. In terms of kind of the work that I did at Penn State, it was pretty intense. But we can talk more about that in a little bit.
So just to backtrack a little bit, sure. So you say you're an Indian American, and there's a lot of, not necessarily stigma, but a lot of traditional perception about Asian Americans.
Sure.
And of course, there's a lot of overlapping values with an Asian American like myself and an Indian American like yourself. Mm-hmm. So what was like the family dynamic? Because you say you're very close with your brothers, and yep. you had a lot of influences from them.
Yeah.
But how was that with your family, your brothers, your parents overall?
Sure. I think for us, it was probably the biggest value was just closeness with your family. So every vacation, every activity that we did, my parents were always there. We always discussed everything. That was a big thing, was communication in my family. So no matter whether we wanted to try a new sport, whether we wanted to go to a new place, we always tried to come to a consensus. And that was a pretty cool thing. My parents were always pushing me to try to become the best that I could be, really at a young age. A funny memory I have is my mom at the dinner table. She, back in India, used to be on the debate team in like her high school. And when she moved to the United States, she went to school around Philadelphia, like college around Philadelphia. She did debate there too. And so she always wanted us to be well-adjusted to American lifestyle. And a big part of that, I think, for immigrants is just being able to not only literally speak the language, but speak like, I guess, people that have been here for several generations. And there's a certain vernacular. There's a certain way of conversing that I think...
The culture.
Yeah, the people who have been here for a while, they simply speak like, right? They're able to flow through conversations with a certain body of knowledge, whether that's talking about sports, whether that's talking about shared experiences that people that have been here for 100 years can do. Our parents always, you know, emphasized that they wanted us to be able to do that. And so that's probably why they put us in so many activities. But also, the funny memory is at our dinner table, my mom had my brother and I do like a mock presidential debate. And she would ask us funny questions like...
Was she the moderator?
Yeah, she would lob us questions like, what do you think is your favorite quality about yourself? And we would on the spot have to say, you know, what we think is our favorite part of ourselves, but we also had to consider what other people would like, right? So we had to put ourselves in the mindset of other people in order to be persuasive in like the fifth grade. It seems it seems pretty intense, but it was a cool activity. We enjoyed it. It was just the culture of our family. And I think it definitely helped when later on I went to a big state school where there was definitely kind of an expectation that you're able to go with the flow and be chill. And making it kind of in the business finance world, there's also an expectation that you're quite socially capable and have a high EQ. So it was nice. It was like a cool way to grow up, though some may find it a little bit intense. It's funny, Aiden, that you ask, like, was I a hard worker? I know you and I have had conversations with about this before.
Mm-hmm.
In high school, and I guess even starting late middle school, I wasn't very focused. My parents always harped on, like, doing your homework, getting good grades. It's really important. But I never really put the pieces together. I was like in a rock band. I played the drums. Like I had a girlfriend in late middle school.
Were you DJing at that time too?
Yeah. I mean, I was into electronic music. And so my brother and I would go to like festivals at the age of 14. Like, I don't know. I had a lot of other focuses other than school. And so I was in all the most challenging classes. I was in like the gifted program, whatever. But I just had horrendous grades. When it came down to it, I could achieve at stuff like the SAT and stuff like that, but my teachers really hated me because I didn't put my full effort into it. And so it wasn't until college where I really kind of buckled up and did what it took because I realized what my goals were.
And what do you think caused that shift going into college? Like kind of saying it's, oh, this is real now, or was it something specific that happened? Like what kind of about Penn State or about college made you realize that you had to put, you know, the full foot forward?
Sure. I think this is like a common, from my understanding, this is a pretty common thing that happens to some kids in high school where, though I took pretty hard classes and there was interesting subject matter, I felt like I wasn't really engaged. I wasn't really being pushed to do my all. And so I didn't really feel an incentive to, you know, color within the lines and get an A or like do my homework. I wanted to be a little bit more stimulated. And so it was pretty interesting. Junior year of high school, through the gifted program, we were able to do some like job shadowings where we just went to different Fortune 500 companies, like a wealth advisor, an insurance company, a tech company. And we just were able to shadow people for a day and get some early exposure to like a pre-professional life. I ended up at a place called ING, which is like an insurance company. And they had presenters come in and they would tell us a little bit about what they do. Now, at this point, like a cousin of mine had introduced me to like some stock trading software, and he told me to just play with it because that was the industry that he was in. I didn't know anything about stocks, I mean, other than just the stuff that you see on television, and I had no fundamental knowledge. I just thought you were just playing with paper money like Monopoly. I had no idea what I was doing, but I had a little bit of exposure just to this game, so I knew what it was, and I saw some like the formulas that go into calculating ratios behind stocks. And so that piqued my interest because that was something that wasn't related to textbooks in school. And it could stretch your brain in a way that a lot of kids aren't able to stretch. So it piqued my interest. I didn't want to do my homework. I wanted to figure out stocks. So when I went on this job shadowing, one guy, as they were rotating through the departments, he was in the hedging department where they work with complex derivatives. So it's like stocks, but a lot harder to understand.
Quant.
It's quant stuff.
Yep.
And he threw this formula up on the board. It's called the Black-Scholes option pricing model. Basically what that means is just like a complex statistical formula that helps you price derivatives, which are like complex stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I guess, was flexing on the kids a little bit, which is funny because we were all 17.
all those
eight? Yeah, I don't know. It was probably like 50. And he was like the head of the department, but I guess he just wanted to show that like what he did was complicated. He's a great guy. He became one of the biggest mentors of my life, so I don't want to flame him too hard. But he was flexing on 17-year-olds. It's funny. And I actually knew what the formula was, so I was able to kind of break down some of the pieces. And I guess that impressed him to the point where he mentored me through my senior year of high school. He taught me how to use Microsoft Excel at like a high level in kind of the world of hedging and finance. Excel is like a really powerful tool and they use it every day. So he taught me how to use it, how to code within Visual Basic, which is like a coding software within Excel.
VSA. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And do some really high level things for a high schooler, I think.
Yeah.
At least, you know, from what I had been exposed to at that point.
Very advanced for a 17-year-old.
So we started building some cool products just like after school. that really lit a fire in me to the point where I would come back from school and I still wouldn't do my homework, but I would just sit there for 6 hours and I would just learn how to code within Excel. And I would build these crazy outputs and I would, you know, my computer is really slow. And so I would build a code. I would have it iterate through, you know, these crazy formulas that spat out all these results in a cool looking way, but it would take 10 hours. And so I would hit go at midnight and I'd wake up in the morning for school and it would finally be done. And I would see the results were just a little bit off and I had to change the code by 2 lines, but I loved that. It didn't frustrate me. It just made me want to learn more and more. So I did an internship after my senior year of high school at ING, like a full-time internship. And it was a really cool accomplishment. It was really only juniors in college or above that got it. And so though I was a little bit like a junior intern, it was still like an interesting experience to have. And I think once I got that intellectual stimulation, that's what made me think finance is what I want to do. It's a place where you can stretch your mind, you know, way further than any other subject that I had encountered to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt like what I'm really deep down looking for is to be intellectually stimulated or challenged, then this is a field that I can dive deep into and I can enjoy it. So I like competed in these international finance competitions at the end of high school. I had a lot of success. My parents had started a few like small businesses while I was growing up. I had experience, like kind of interaction with corporate finance in that way. I started getting a little bit more involved there. And of course I had this internship. So when I went to Penn State, went into business school, studied finance, and from day one, my GPA rose like a full point. I like started doing my homework. I knew like I really wanted to make it in this field, and I knew that you needed to carry a good GPA. You needed to do a lot of extracurriculars, get the work experience. I just had to grow up, and having that immense, really bespoke, really highly tailored experience when I was 17 years old, being at ING and having such a tight mentor, that's what really sparked me. Yeah. So I was really lucky to have had that experience. I think it was pretty defining for my life.
So quick question. So you said, I also could relate a little bit in high school where I didn't really try too hard, but different people come with different baseline of IQ. Of course, it's an outdated metric. So do you think you didn't try as hard in high school because you didn't have, or you didn't respect the metric as much, or is it because you lacked intellectual stimulation?
I mean that high school wasn't intellectually stimulating enough for him?
For him to try. Yeah. So was it the fact that high school was too easy for you, so that lacked that intellectual stimulation aspect, so you didn't want to try as hard? Or is it because you didn't really respect the metric of the traditional GPA metrics in high school?
I think a little bit of a combination. I didn't really understand how important like getting good grades and having like a well-rounded resume and application was to getting into good schools. Like I always aspired, as you said, like there's a lot of pressure with having like immigrant parents. I mean, it's not just immigrant parents. Everybody, you know, depending on the way you're raised, has certain levels of pressure. But my parents were pretty gung-ho about getting to a really good school and being professionally successful. And so I didn't realize what it took to get into an amazing school. I mean, when of course Penn State's an amazing school, I mean like to get to like an Ivy League or something similar. I didn't realize that you had to be top of your class, you had to be immensely involved extracurricularly, etc. I thought if you showed your passion and dove really deeply into that, then why wouldn't somebody be convinced that you can be a star? So once I had, you know, the finance competitions that I did in high school and I succeeded on an international level with that, and once I had this corporate internship at the age of 17, I was like, come on, every college admissions counselor is going to say, wow, this kid's going to be a star as soon as he applies himself. We should give him a shot. And man, I applied to like 12 schools and I only got into one.
There's millions of stars. Yeah.
So I definitely did not respect how much work it took. But that said, like, yeah, I would probably also agree with the idea that high school wasn't super stimulating. I mean, I liked some of my classes, but it wasn't until I found the subject matter of finance that I was like, I'm going to spend the actual hours. It's a pretty interesting thing. I can touch on a little bit later. One of my coworkers at Bank of America, where I ended up in New York, He told me something pretty profound. He said, it's so simple. He said, if you look at the number of hours that somebody spent studying in high school or in college, literally just not necessarily how smart they are, not necessarily what opportunities they pursued or where they ended up. If you just look at the number of hours that they spent, that directionally and pretty accurately will tell you how successful they will be in terms of achieving their goals.
Just a sheer work ethic.
Just, yeah. And a lot of people think of work ethic as like this ephemeral, multivariable thing. He distilled it down to number of hours.
Just quantify just hours.
Yeah. And so he's a pretty interesting guy in terms of his story, but I really respect him and how far he went with having such little resources. And when he distilled it down to just number of hours, it kind of framed every success that I've had in the past or every failure that I've had in the past. It is pretty funny that directionally speaking, it really comes down to like how much time did I spend in trying to get it. Finance was the first thing that I really spent a lot of time and effort trying to get into. And so once I got to college, I think having that, that's what made me want to work hard.
I think that's really illuminating because it really shows you can get good at anything if you just put your mind to it. I mean, obviously hours and hours, hundreds of hours is a lot to put into any specific one task. Like all the modeling experience you've done, all the competitions, like that's a lot of time, but to your friend's point, you can kind of get good at whatever it is if you just put in the time and the work to it.
Definitely.
So, you know, it's pretty clear after that whole explanation, you worked really hard at Penn State. Mm-hmm. Where did that bring you into New York? Or kind of how did that passion in finance evolve after graduation?
Could I talk a little bit about like what I did at Penn State to try to get there?
Yeah, of course. Definitely. That's actually would give some clarity and, you know, background to that experience.
Definitely. I tried kind of like a multi-pronged approach to this.
Multi-pronged approach to your Penn State experience?
Yeah, I mean, to my Penn State experience, but really just like the overarching goal of getting to that Wall Street job.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize it until way later, but I...
Way later as in like...
Once I got to New York.
Real quick though, I want to point out, you knew that Wall Street was kind of the end goal.
Definitely.
Like coming in freshman year, you knew that that was kind of the thing on the other side of Penn State.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
The moment you entered the Smale College Shriars, that was your vision.
Before that. So the summer before college, I was making a decision where I wanted to go. I actually got into two schools. I was lying.
All right.
So it's 2 out of 12. Yeah, it's 2 out of 12. And I was deciding which program I wanted to go to. And I realized there were some really great student organizations at Penn State that kind of were a good funnel for students to get high finance jobs. And so I knew that I wanted to get involved the moment I stepped on campus. I had this internship and I thought I was like a hot shot. I thought I was ahead of all my peers and how wrong I was. But the summer before college, I called the professor that ran like the Penn State Investment Association. And I said, hey, I want to be involved in this. How do I do it? And it's as simple as just going to the meeting. You just sign your name up for a listserv, right? But I thought it was some competitive process and I wanted to get so ahead of it that the summer before I was like calling that professor. It was like just a funny thing.
He's like, I'm on my vacation, dude.
Yeah, he's like, what are you calling me for? Just show up Tuesday, the second week. But I knew that I wanted to end up in high finance. I wasn't 100% sure of Wall Street, but I knew I wanted to do like an investing role.
Mm-hmm.
Can you unpack, so for people who are, because I'm not in finance myself,
sure.
I was a management consultant, but I was not in finance.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between high finance and versus other terminology of just regular finance?
Sure. I mean, it's kind of a loose term. I generally split the field of finance into a few different categories. You can have things like wealth management where you're helping individuals or small groups just manage their money.
Like Vanguard?
Yeah, like a Vanguard where that's like an investment management. I know it's a small changing term. But if you help people manage their money, I generally think of that as like wealth or investment management. If you're in an advisory role, then investment banking falls under that. And basically you're advising companies on how to raise money or advising them on how to sell part of their business to somebody else or advising them on how to buy part of a part or a whole another business. I generally think of high finance as encapsulating either like a wealth or investment management or an investing role, like a trading role or like a corporate advisory role. Basically something that takes a lot of technical ability and deep knowledge of like the financial product that you're trying to sell, whether that's I'm going to help you invest in mutual funds, that's like a product. Whether you're saying I'm going to help you sell part of your business, that's a product. Whether you're literally trading stocks as if like you see in movies, that's a product. So that's what I think of as the high finance industry.
So they're alluding more towards the high stake versus high stress or high workload. If you are to boil onto that, like simplified
sure.
term. Okay.
Sure. There are other facets of like professional finance where like corporate finance, where you're helping a company manage like their treasury and their budgets and their forecasts, etc. it's separate. I guess if I really, that's an interesting question. If I really had to boil it down, it's probably like helping people manage their money is probably high finance to me in general. So whether you're helping companies manage their money and actually do stuff with it, all the way to helping individuals like pick what they're going to do with their 401k, I think of that as high finance.
So Quantitrade, hedge fund, those will under fall under the umbrella of high finance.
Sure.
Got it. So I just wanted to clarify for myself and for the people out there.
No problem.
So what did this group at Penn State do? Was this a high finance or was this actually a stock market type of club? Like, were you picking stocks? Were you analyzing and presenting? What did this know, club kind of look like?
It was, so the investment association was very much, it was broken into sectors. Mm-hmm. So some people focused on technology companies, some people focused on healthcare companies, some people on just general industrial companies like that make hardware and whatnot. And within each sector, they taught us kind of the basics of how do you analyze the financial prospect of a company. And it takes a lot to unpack that, right? So at a basic level, you go through a valuation exercise where you use some quantitative methods and you say the stock is worth this much or the bond is worth this much. And but to do that, you have to figure out how much cash flow the business makes. In order to do that, you have to figure out what its revenues and its costs are. In order to do that, you have to deeply understand how the company works and what its products are, who its customers are, like just like how it makes money. So it goes all the way from the hyper quantitative, which is like the valuation of a company, like the financial model, which is purely quantitative, all the way to understanding the numbers to put into that model, which is very qualitative. So it's like, is this phone going to sell better than this phone? How many people do I think are going to be interested in this product? So they kind of touched on each piece of that and prepared us to do these types of analyses for a quote high finance job, like an investment banking or a sales and trading.
So you did this your entire Penn State career?
Yeah. I mean, I did it the first 3 years. Okay. And then once I got my internship, I tapered off towards senior year.
For sure.
Typical senior year thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Makes sense.
Senioritis.
Yeah. A little bit.
Other things to do.
But that was kind of the goal of the club. And I got involved in a few others, Penn State Finance Society. Started my own philanthropic organization, the Penn State Microfinance Initiative, where we made like some extremely small loans to entrepreneurs in developing economies, places like, you know, Kenya, India, places in South America, etc., so that they can kind of create their own jobs, their own businesses, and help themselves climb out of difficult financial situations. That was, I guess, an extracurricular outside of my pursuit of investment banking, but it kind of ties in, right? You're providing loans to entrepreneurs. So
I think it ties in really well because that was something that I took part in with Nick at Penn State. We kind of, I don't know, he started the club and then
we started it together.
Of course. For sure.
Co-founders.
Yeah, co-founders. I made the...
You're a founding board member. You're the treasurer.
I was the treasurer, wrote some checks, organized the money and stuff. But it was just a really interesting approach to having a group because usually there's either a fundraising club, like a philanthropy type thing, or something like you're fundraising or you're putting on events, right? And this was kind of that sustainable philanthropy that no matter how many events we did, because it was all interest-based, it would continue to grow, right? So how would that business model work, right? Like we lent to investors or we lent to businesses and then they would pay back at a smaller rate than they would get to banks.
Yeah.
So it was advantageous for both parties. Our money was continuing to grow, kind of like the stock market, but the investors were also getting cheaper interest rates than the banks would offer.
Definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it's loosely related, right? Because we were operating like a typical bank that lends out to small businesses and individuals. It's just we were doing it at such a small scale. And like in terms of per loan amounts were maybe like $50. And, you know, we were very flexible in terms of the terms and how long it could be and what their repayment terms were like. It was very much mission oriented, but it had what's known as like a double bottom line. We wanted to make profits, but we also wanted to do good. And so there was like a lighter feel to our culture where people actually wanted to help rather than just having a pure profit motive. But it also felt grounded in like a sustainable business model because our money was growing like a bank would. So it felt good to be doing something that was a little bit different. And it was tech enabled. You know, we used mobile banking and a few like interesting business models where there were no intermediaries, there was no predatory lending, there was no one banging down your door if your small business in, you know, rural India didn't work out, mm-hmm. which added to the like the good feeling, because there's a big critique of the industry that it's like payday loans, and it gets a little bit of a bad rep that way, where you're like lending money to people that don't have good credit and try to make a buck off of them. But we did it in such a way that we were a lot more flexible, the idea was that the goodwill of that and the fact that we didn't have people banging down people's doors, that cost money, and we didn't have offices in people's countries, so we were able to keep costs low. Uh-huh. So even though potentially people might not pay you back as much if you don't enforce so hard, because your costs are so low, theoretically it balances out in a profit way. Uh-huh. So it's just a really cool business model that I discovered early on at Penn State. I had some awesome friends that were dedicated to the cause, Aiden being one of them, and we were able to build like a cool culture around it, and it tied into my love of finance and whatnot. So that was a fun thing that I did.
So could I probe a little bit further? So you and Aiden kind of gloss over the fact that this enterprise, social enterprise you call it, was running under the scope of internationality, right? So yes. If you talk about like how did you relate, let alone reinforce and establish and even become profitable, right?
Definitely. Yeah, there are a few interesting organizations that already exist at scale. And by at scale, I mean, these are US-based nonprofits that have 10 to 100, sometimes more than hundreds of millions of dollars under management that they're lending out to entrepreneurs in these developing economies. So microfinance is like a multi-billion dollar industry. Luckily, early on at Penn State, I was introduced to an organization called Zedisha. And the founder wanted to do a tech-enabled approach to microfinance. So the typical business model of microfinance is they fundraise in developed economies like the United States, where people want to take their money and contribute it to philanthropy, but they like the idea of sustainable philanthropy, where they're not giving a man a fish, they're kind of giving a man or woman the means to buy a rod to fish. Right? That's kind of the idea of a microloan. And so billions are raised in places like the United States to go towards microfinance, but traditional organizations have taken that money, given it to financial institutions in countries like India, Bangladesh, developing economies. And those financial, I guess, intermediaries then make small loans to entrepreneurs in those countries. Now, the problem is because they have so much overhead and the loans are so small, the interest rates tend to be pretty high. Sometimes the interest rates range as high
to
as...
To offset the risk and all the margins.
Yeah, so the interest rates are like 35%, right, in some cases. And when you have an interest rate that high and you're using that loan to literally raise chickens and sell the eggs, or you're buying a bicycle in order to distribute newspapers, or you're running like an internet cafe and you're just buying one or two computers, then it just becomes a very high-risk enterprise because you're very highly levered. Right? Meaning you have such a high interest payment on that debt that if your business isn't successful immediately and sustainably, then you're gonna default on the debt. You're going to go into foreclosure. Some people might bang down your door and, you know, try to take your things or rough you up or intimidate you. And so it just became a really, I guess, tainted practice. I know in India, which is one of the first places that it existed, it's the biggest market for microfinance. It got banned by the government for several years because people were, you know,
malicious practices and,
you know, predatory lending was ruining people's lives. So this organization, Zedisha, they were using mobile banking. So people could set up a bank account with a local bank and they would use a money transfer system called M-Pesa.
Goes directly to, oh, I've heard this before.
Yeah, and so the money would go directly from the Zedisha online platform, where it's like, you go on Zedisha.com, there's a bunch of profiles of entrepreneurs that say, I'm so-and-so, I went to school at this place, I want to raise the money for this business, this is how much I want, this is how I'm going to spend it. They do like a whole business mock-up, and then you lend them $5, you press the button, and after they've raised enough money, it's like Kickstarter, the money goes right to their phone and into their bank account. So very low overhead. Our interest rates ranged from 5 to 10%. So, and like, we didn't have anybody busting down doors. So people appreciated the fact that we were flexible with our loans. The interest rates were lower, so our default rates were really low and people were happy. That was supposed to be like the tech-enabled approach to it. And that was our new wave business model. So I decided to get involved with the organization by leading campus outreach, which was something that they didn't have before. And I started the club at Penn State. I built all the infrastructure where started like a Google Drive. I created folders for all the different tasks that we had to do and all the different little teams that we wanted. I created individual assignments for different people based on kind of my friend group that I started this club with. Built all the different forms, created mailing lists, etc. And I was really trying to create this sustainable infrastructure that other people could branch out to different colleges with. So because we were kind of the pilot, we had to build it all ourselves. We were going to raise the money, have a great time doing it, and then put the money on the platform, you know, evaluate entrepreneurs and their business models as we saw fit, and actually just transfer the money right to the entrepreneurs. And so it would be a sustainable philanthropy in that way. That was our whole business.
So through that whole experience, both the, you know, people ecosystem of it, as well as the lending to people in need, what do you think's kind of the biggest lesson that that whole microfinance initiative taught you?
That's interesting. I think you can believe in something and not be super motivated to work at it at the same time. So that kind of taught me my first lesson in culture. And I realized way later on, maybe not realized, I guess this is just a perspective that I heard. I started listening to a lot of entrepreneurship podcasts once I got to New York. And one of the things that I heard was that culture isn't necessarily, do you go paintballing together on weekends? Do you have a ping pong table? Like, do you drink with your colleagues? It's much more, do you align in terms of vision? But even more so, do you align in terms of what it's going to take to get to that vision? What are you willing to do to achieve your collective vision? And so the podcast that I listened to, it boiled it down to, is this going to take up a lot of your life or not? Is this going to be just a 9-to-5 that you do and you're living for the out of work? Or is this going to be a big part of your life? And so when I started this organization, I thought, you know, I'm going to work several hours a day on this. I really want this mission to work out. It's like a part of who I am. It ties into my interests. And so I'm going to grind at it. And I want people that are going to work hard at it too. And I made the mistake of, if they agree with the vision, then that means they're going to want to work at it. They're incentivized because they agree with the mission. But I think my first lesson in culture was, just because somebody believes in the mission doesn't mean they fit the culture in terms of being doing what it takes to achieve that mission. So my first lesson in building teams was, you have to figure out, to hire properly, you have to figure out whether the individual is willing to do what it takes to achieve the mission. Are they willing to put literally the number of hours into doing, to setting out and doing the individual tasks, no matter how mundane, no matter how much they stretch you out of your comfort zone to achieve the mission. So that was kind of my first lesson in team building and what culture really is.
Well, how do you think you can accomplish that in culture? Does it come from the top down, just in expectation? Or, you know, obviously it is important not to just see the vision, but to see the process to get there. But is it kind of management's responsibility to have that trickle down, or where does that expectation come from?
Sure. That's an interesting question. So I don't have enough management experience to be able to say this definitively. I'm going to disclaimer it with that, right?
Absolutely.
I can tell you what I think I know, but I don't think I know much yet.
Speak your truth.
Sure. I don't think it's necessarily that the culture can flow from the top down. I think the culture has to be pervasive from day one. And it has to be in the individual's heart when they step in the door. So I think it's much more of a hiring thing than it is, once the individual is there, they can absorb the culture from the top down. So I think it's a very important mission for whoever's making the hiring decision to understand what the culture is and find and screen individuals that are going to join the team that fit that culture before they even get there. So in terms of setting that culture, sure, it's the people that have the founding vision. But in terms of kind of making that vision come to fruition, I think having that work ethic that kind of equates to culture has to begin with a good hiring decision.
So you're saying that nature is more important than the nurturing, because for the culture to take place and to really foster, you really have to pick the right applicants to begin with who already have that built-in mentality. Would that be fair to say?
That's a tough question. So the research that I've seen, and there are a lot of individuals that I respect that have spoken on this subject, I'd probably say there is something within every individual's nature that does guide them towards being just a natural hard worker or not. But I think, especially in like my own case, I think I'm a good case study of your nature, or rather your nurture and kind of your environment, your upbringing, the individuals that you associate with, the opportunities that you have, you know, around you, the media that you absorb, everything. Mm-hmm. I think that does have an impact on bringing out that nature from you. So it's got to be a combination of things. But I do think directionally, some people do have a nature that is hardworking versus not as much. Or maybe a better way of saying it is they're just a better fit for a different culture, right? You can achieve a mission working 9-to-5. You can achieve a mission working, you know, not in a central office, working remotely. You can achieve a mission taking vacation and having generous benefits and having other priorities in your life. Or you can achieve a mission by just grinding your eyeballs out, you know, 80, 90, 100 hours a week. It's just they're different cultures that can still lead to accomplishing a goal. I don't think individuals that have different natures or not the right nature can't be the right, or rather can't achieve certain missions. It's just each company or each organization is going to have a culture. And it's very important for the people with the founding vision, their culture to line up with those that they hire. Or rather, the opposite way around. Those that join the organization should match the culture of those with the founding vision. Otherwise, it creates a lot of friction, right? If the people with the founding vision say, or rather think that, you know, we should be really grinding at this, this should be an important part of your life, it should be a priority, mm-hmm. and then the people that they bring on, it turns out that's not how they feel, it creates friction, it creates bad will, and that stagnates an organization more than anything that I've seen or heard.
I think talking about culture right now kind of is a good transition into the Wall Street, because sure. as we said, there's a lot of different approaches to culture, and I'd say that Wall Street has one of the most interesting, if you want to put it, culture.
Mystified.
Yeah. Culture. There's definitely a lot of, you know, stigma behind what Wall Street is, or, you know, people have heard stories or tales, but what was your experience in that culture? How was the whole process kind of, I mean, even getting the Wall Street job was probably a culture in itself, the whole networking yep. and interview process. I guess, could you walk us through how that looked?
It was pretty different. I think getting to the job was very different than once you were on the job. Mm-hmm. So Penn State culture is pretty relaxed. People like each other. They want to work hard, but it's called Happy Valley for a reason, right?
They want to play hard too.
Yeah, and it's less just about like playing hard. It's more like, I don't think people take themselves as seriously. And by that, I mean they don't go overboard.
Uh-huh. You're saying about the competition lens? Is that what you're alluding to in terms of?
Yeah, partially the competition, but really just kind of the zeitgeist and just the overall identity of a Penn Stater is very much like collaborative, wants to get a lot done, but isn't necessarily trying to bring others down, right? They don't see it as a zero-sum game. They see it as we're going to build good relationships, we're going to accomplish our goals, and we're going to have a good time while doing it. So through the recruiting process, I had a lot of great friends, a lot of really great like mentors and peers that I was able to learn from and bounce ideas off of and teach. A lot of really great people that had made it onto Wall Street from Penn State. And luckily there is like a decent Penn State network on Wall Street now. It's taken a long time to build. But though there aren't that many individuals there in terms of number, almost everybody that is in those jobs wants to help younger Penn Staters make it. And so the culture when I was trying to get the job was awesome. It was like almost a fun journey. Mm-hmm. Once you get there, you start interacting with individuals that are just different, right? They take themselves a lot more seriously. Some of them see it as more of a zero-sum game where anybody's accomplishment takes away from them, or their accomplishment is a way of setting other people back, which like eliminates threats. People build friendships differently.
Differently in what sense? Like a transactional sense or?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of like a social climber where somebody will hang out with an individual or a group of people because they think it'll be good for their professional life, or they think it's just a reliable source of social interaction. And so, like, once they get the opportunity to open that door to a new friend group or a new professional opportunity, they walk through it and they kind of close it behind them. Of course, this isn't everybody.
Yeah.
I just think you run into more individuals like that in a high pressure, high intensity environment, like investment banking or just in New York City in general. So it was very different than the experience of getting there.
Probably almost in a sharp contrast to the what you alluded to, kind of everyone's in it together approach of Penn State.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, Penn State itself, there was definitely an idea of, like, not haves or have-nots, but, like, insiders versus outsiders. I think you had to have an interesting thing. Once you make it to New York, you find a lot of people there that are just brilliant. Clearly, they have a lot of intellectual hardware that will take them very far in life and have gotten them to prestigious jobs. But I think at Penn State, it's a lot more important to have the right EQ and build the right relationships. So you found a lot of people that were in similar Greek organizations or similar student organizations and built relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a huge boost to their ability to network properly with those on Wall Street for them to get the internships that they needed to convert it into full-time offers. I think it was really important to have enough EQ at Penn State, almost in a way where at other schools that were bigger feeders to Wall Street programs, so like Ivy League schools, the MITs of the world, I think a lot of people that made it to those jobs from those schools did it more so from mental hardware, like IQ.
Just inheritance.
Yeah.
Hardware.
In short, I hate to make a blanket statement, they were just so smart they couldn't be turned away. They didn't necessarily need the amount of EQ that you need in order to make it from Penn State. You have to be really personable.
How did that affect how you know, showed up on the day-to-day or even how you were interacting with, say, these really high IQ kids? Was it kind of your responsibility to be the socialite of Wall Street in some ways, or like kind of connect being, you know, using the EQ from Penn State in a completely different environment? You know, or what did that kind of look like, you know, in terms of culture at Wall Street?
Sure. So I definitely would not say I was a socialite at Wall Street.
Gotcha.
Almost everybody has some baseline of ability to converse and
no one's on the spectrum.
Like people know how to have good conversations once you're there. It's very rare that you'll find somebody with like the inability to connect with others there. You have to, right? It's a client-facing business. You're advising Fortune 100 companies on buying and selling company like themselves or other companies and how to raise money. You're working with hedge funds, private equity companies, those with billions of dollars. These guys and girls, they know how to build personal relationships really well. I just think their attitude towards it is a little different. At Penn State, it was very genuine. It was very authentic. They wanted to be friends with each other. They wanted to help. Whereas some people on Wall Street were a little bit more mission-driven in their personal interactions. And so you could kind of see it when, like, again, in the social climber example that I gave, where people were good at making relationships, but it just seemed like they had a goal in mind a lot of times.
You think it's the element of exclusivity, like exclusivity? So they're a little bit more exclusive in terms of their identity of, you know, they're a former Ivy League, whatever.
Yep.
Their intellectual inheritance in hardware. You think that's what drove them to be a little bit afar and different from?
Yeah. I mean, there definitely was some aspect of exclusivity and I don't want to say entitlement or feeling better than. I would probably more say, again, they frame it more as like a zero-sum thing. So if they have a group of friends, they know it's working for them. It's a good counterbalance to the 90-hour work week. Perhaps they don't want to let others in that might stir the pot or, you know, move them away from the core of the group, etc. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's an interesting topic because Aiden and I, we talked about in our previous episode. So I went to grad school at Penn. That's how I ended up in Philadelphia. And I was peers with a lot of people who went to Ivy League for undergrad, like Cornell, Penn. And I went to Penn State and I was triers, whatever. However, I could tell that. So I think similar to you, before I went to Penn for grad school and even Penn State for undergrad, Auburn being Honors College, I always felt like I was definitely better than most people. Not hourly speaking, but I feel like I didn't have to try as hard to achieve the same outcome. And I got to Penn and then all these are brilliant, like ingenious peers, right? They're brilliant. They had impeccable work ethics and X, Y, and Z factors. But if I were to really compare us holistically, I embodied way paramount level of social and emotional intelligence as some of my peers did who went to Ivy League undergrad, you know? And however, because of grad school, maybe it's very different element as Wall Street per se, that it wasn't necessarily zero sum at all.
Sure.
However, I could tell that it was that I could tell I was at edge advantage of in terms of the social emotional intelligence aspect.
Sure.
And similarly for Aiden, when he was at EY for, you know, when he was for the Big Four accounting, he was pierced with a lot of brilliant people who went to maybe better, more prestigious schools. However, he was able to excel in those interactions because he had those Penn State influences.
Sure.
But it sounds like those were not as relevant to your Wall Street experience because of maybe it's just like a different league or just different ball game.
Yeah, it was a little different. I think another way of talking about how it's different is people that made it to Wall Street, they were socially capable. They were able to build relationships and whatnot. I just think they were a little bit perhaps reserved in a strategic way. So, for example, a lot of my peers, when we would go out, let's say we went to a driving range.
You knew Wall Street people.
Yeah. So like when I worked at Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, in the investment banking division. When my team would go for like a company outing or a team outing, if we would go to a driving range, if there were individuals that didn't know how to hit a golf ball properly, those that could, there were a lot of people that were amazing at golf there, but they wouldn't like step up and teach somebody how to do it. Whether that was because they were a little bit more reserved and didn't want to seem like they were imposing or kind of trying to be better than others, and they didn't want that perception, so they just didn't teach, or whether they wanted to keep that upper hand and be impressive in their own right and not have others catch up to them in that sense. No matter what the reason, they were just more reserved. Whereas I think coming from Penn State and just kind of my own nature, I would always step up and be like, okay, here's some feedback on how you can change your swing. Try it like this. I even taught people how to throw a football in the office because that's something we would do.
Big Ten.
Yeah. And I was not very good at throwing a football, right? Nobody in my family ever really did it. And so I only ever did it with my friends in college. But I at least tried to help my peers that weren't very good at it try to have some form. which is like a funny thing because none of my other peers who clearly knew how to do it would do it. They were much more reserved, whether it was strategic or whether it was just their personality. They were just more reserved. And so perhaps their EQ was just different. They exhibited it in different ways. And as I progressed through my job, I realized there's no maybe counterintuitive ways of showing yourself and your personality that benefit you. So for me, So in general, but myself as an example, anytime one of my bosses would walk by, I was happy to chirp them up about like the Giants losing to the Eagles, right? They're all New York Giants fans.
Of course.
And so, you know, if a Philadelphia sports team beat theirs, I would be happy to say, what happened on Sunday? You guys fell apart. Which is, it seems normal to us to have, you know, conversations like that and I guess to pull each other's leg, but other individuals that were around me were a lot more reserved and they would never do something like that. And so for some of my bosses, that would work. And I was able to build closer relationships with them because I would do something like that. For some of my bosses, they started to get this perception of me as somebody who thinks maybe a little too much about sports or maybe is a little bit too liberal with the things that he says.
Overimposing.
Yeah. It's just like perhaps too boisterous. Is that appropriate? Like, can we take this guy to a client meeting? Is he going to show enough professional restraint? So the way that I was raised or the environment that I had growing up all the way through college, that's just the kind of things that we would say to each other. And kind of learning that professional restraint from some of my peers who either naturally gravitated towards being reserved or strategically were a little bit more reserved, I had to adopt that aspect of their EQ. So what I think is like a higher EQ is being comfortable chirping at your boss. But what they think is high EQ might be showing that professional restraint. And in some ways, they're right. And in some ways, I was right. So EQ is not linear. It's mm-hmm. such a multifaceted thing that I think I was able to learn a lot of really great interpersonal skills from people that when I went in, I thought, oh, these people are quiet. Maybe they don't know how to build relationships as well. But I ended up learning a lot from them.
Yeah, it all depends on circumstance, I think. I had the exact same experience working, you know, at EY back in the day, because it's exactly that. You need to kind of figure out what's appropriate for the workplace, what's appropriate for the client-facing meetings. Mm-hmm. And as much as it is important to kind of have that, not to say carefree, but kind of just lighthearted approach to your personal interactions, it obviously is a time and place for it, right? So mm-hmm. it's definitely not linear. It's kind of, I'd say, circumstantial based on kind of what's going on at the present time.
Definitely.
Yeah, but I actually, I've never thought about that.
What?
It's like, because like perception is reality, right?
Dude, honestly.
And dude, that is because even when I was a Penn dude, I was shitting on some of my peers. I was like, you went to a better, more prestigious undergrad than I did. But I was like, dude, like, you're fucking socially awkward. You don't know how to talk to people. You don't know how to, like, network as well as I do. You don't know how to build rapport. But it might be the exact same thing, the lenses you went through. You're like,
yeah.
They're not less capable. They're just choosing not to. It's a strategic.
Yeah.
And almost the counter of what, and even the counter of what you said a couple weeks ago is when you're comparing your weaknesses to their strengths.
Comparison is
strengths.
Comparison's always your weakness to someone else's strength.
Mm-hmm. Or your strength to their weakness.
Yep. Vice versa.
Which, I don't know, it is kind of always changing with, I mean, that's kind of why I heard a saying of comparison is the thief of joy. So just like in anything, just
Elon Musk.
Is that Elon Musk? Yeah.
Yes,
just don't compare to other things. It's like same idea with expectation. If you're not comparing, you're not expecting anything.
Yeah.
There's not going to be any problems. You know, you just go in and accept whatever that present thing is.
Yeah. It's tough. Understand and agree with the core of what you're saying from like a mental health perspective,
mm-hmm.
but an interesting way that I came to view this, because I always saw myself as like a pretty confident guy. I thought I was pretty carefree. I loved meeting and interacting with people. I just enjoyed being myself,
mm-hmm.
and you know, whether other people caught the vibe, great. If they didn't, whatever, that's their loss. That's just kind of how I was raised. That's how I've always been.
You were living with a mentality of no regrets, right?
Yeah.
You're doing you.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say no regrets, but I definitely tried to be as myself as possible. Yeah. So if you go to an investment bank and there's somebody with 30 years of experience walking by your desk and you know, after 3-4 weeks of meeting them and you're an intern, if you're willing to, you know, pull their leg about sports and how their team just got crushed by yours, That's being as myself as possible, right? But as happy as that made me, and sometimes it worked, sometimes I was able to build good relationships, I think just thinking about what is the right thing to do from a mental health perspective was not the right thing to do from a professional perspective,
mm-hmm.
right? So an interesting story I have is some of my coworkers that were like my peers that were on the same level as me. This is like a...
Like professional level.
Yeah, yeah. So they were literally the next desk over. They were also interns from different schools. This is like it's a tough subject to talk about because it was, I don't want to call it like a traumatic experience, but it like changed the way that I think about who I am and how I interact with the world. So it was pretty big. They, throughout my internship, we would hang out, we would go to each other's apartments, you know, chat, eat, drink. And sometimes we would go to clubs and we would dance. We would just do 21-year-old stuff in New York. And it was fun. But then when we would get into the office, I started to notice that when I was, quote, a little bit to myself, it would rub them the wrong way. So
what do you mean the wrong way?
They would take it highly negatively and act upon it in a very subversive way. So some of my bosses, if they had assignments, we had like a chief resource officer, where whenever a project came up, it was supposed to go through the chief resource officer, CRO, and that person was supposed to delegate work and track the work of the junior employees so that everybody was on an equal level of interesting and not so interesting stuff, extremely difficult and not so extremely difficult stuff, just chief resource officer.
Such an arbitrary title.
And usually this person was like a VP, which is like a mid-level banker, meaning somebody that's been there like 6 years-ish. And so they know the analyst level lifestyle very well. But they also understand what it takes to be a director, a managing director, and how they expect the work to be done. So they're supposed to be the best at allocating the time and effort of the junior employees. Now, unfortunately, the first team I was on, we didn't have a CRO. And so the work sometimes would get delegated just by nepotism, like whoever has the best relationship with the senior bankers. Sometimes, like, the full-timers would just play a game where they would say, I got a project, who wants it? And you, like, kind of have to literally run for it, which is a really toxic way of delegating work, as I discovered. I saw it as an opportunity to raise my hand for all the work that I can. But I quickly found that by doing that, I was stepping on the toes of my coworkers that would say, this needs to be equal. It needs to be random. Otherwise, you're just going to be building a perception of yourself that we don't have the opportunity to. And it got into interesting dynamics of me being a guy on the team versus there were some girls on the team in the intern class that felt like they were being, you know, overshadowed by a more aggressive personality or a louder voice, or me having relationships with some of the guy bankers that were a little bit more willing to talk about football and, you know, oh yeah, while we're talking about football, here's a project. So it made me really have to take a step back and think about how other people perceive your actions. And so I didn't learn that lesson fast enough. And some of the interns in my class, and once we became full-timers, they started really trying to bring me down because they felt like I was bringing them down. And
during your intern days?
During the intern days, and then even moving into full-time because I joined the same team that I interned at. Every time I would volunteer for something, they would come over my desk and just in a hushed tone, they would flame me as hard as they could. Like, you think being over-aggressive is helping you, it's not, people hate you, you know, they know you didn't come from a good school, they know you're just a try-hard and you don't have any substance, like, why not just give up? Those kinds of things. They stop hanging out with you, they kind of form little alliances, and they
These are your intern class.
Yeah, and they start back-channeling to the full-time bankers that, oh, this person's a bully, this person's over-aggressive, me. Is who they were talking about. This person is taking opportunity away from us. It's unfair. This person's a misogynist. This person is all sorts of things. And it gets into some really dicey territory. It really took the wind out of my sails. I didn't have too many connections in the city of New York in terms of like personal or professional. It was really only what I could build at Penn State. And as I said, there aren't too many there. And so I was trying to build as I got there. So I had to kind of latch on to other friend groups. I had to latch on to other professional networks. I had to build a framework that, and that's okay, right? I had been doing that kind of my whole life, starting in high school. But when you have somebody or several individuals that are actively trying to bring you down because they perceive you either as a threat or a detriment or something, it really can get to you. And it ties into the idea of New York being kind of a very active and social and bubble. Yet very lonely place if you don't have the right kind of relationships. And so I think at times it really did affect me and in some ways break me down. And that was all connected back to me just trying to be my gregarious,
authentic self,
like personable and outgoing self.
Yeah.
So it's funny, we've like tied it all the way back where what I thought was high EQ in building good relationships actually was low EQ, and it was bad strategy because I ended up rubbing my peers the wrong way, and they ended up affecting my mental health in such a way that I wasn't able to perform at my job the right way. So I would call that bad EQ, right?
Or a bad and or toxic workplace environment. Like, if ultimately, obviously that's, you know, kind of a tragic thing that happens, but ultimately it's the job of, you know, the managers to kind of provide an environment where people can collaborate effectively and not, like, by giving the first one to get this project, by handing that out, that's ultimately creating an inherent competition of associate A versus associate B, right? And I think it ultimately comes down to management. Obviously, there is some IQ to decide of what goes into the workplace, but I don't think it should negatively affect how you show up on the day-to-day. You know, like, isn't it kind of the responsibility of a manager to, whatever you want to call it, foster a workplace or a culture where people feel comfortable and can be themselves? So I don't know. It's definitely very tricky because there is that desire to be authentic with yourself or live as, would you say, minimizing regrets of just putting everything you have out there, but finding the circumstance of where it specifically is. So since transitioning, do you think that was a culture of Wall Street specifically, you know, or even other friends in Wall Street? Have you noticed them going through some of those similar qualms?
Well, also before that, so just to allude to your point of, it's always the EV versus actual outcome, which is like the expected value and the actual outcome, is that I feel like it's such a hard thing to quantify because you are generally being your gregarious and authentic self, but your perceived EQ, which was high, objectively, I think it was high EQ, which is perceived, unfortunately, in a low EQ manner by this sector that's very niche, enclosed, a bubbly sector. So I feel like, it is a very tricky territory to tread, but
definitely. There's almost no right or wrong, right? Because,
like you said,
it's all kind of gray at the end of the day because, it's good to put your full self forward in someone, you know, with people that, you know, you're out with. I'm sure you guys were busting it up when you guys were out drinking and dancing and things, but I think it's more of the environment that kind of determines the specific or determines what's appropriate at the given time.
Sure.
Right? Like you probably had to mold what you were doing out on the town rather than in with a client or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. I think in terms of it being gray, I'd say it's more of I learned a lot about how to approach social situations from a place of restraint. I got a lot of practice in gauging how authentic it is appropriate to be at in different situations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of
the Ibiza story when you sat down next to that girl with the violin.
I think
that ties in well.
So Aiden and I traveled after Penn State. We went through Europe. We hit 9 cities in 25 days. And
that was
a really fun experience.
It's fascinating.
But one of the highlight experiences
Ibiza
that we had was when we were flying to Spain and we were flying to Ibiza. And while we were on the flight, I ended up sitting next to a girl who was born and raised there and she had like a violin case. And I just started chatting with her. One of the things that Aiden and I wanted to do while we were there was strike up as many conversations as possible, build as many personal relationships as we can and just try to test our boundaries and just be bold. So I started talking to her about, you know, where in the island or the city she was raised, what kind of things she was into, why she had a violin, basic questions. But then I started going a little bit overboard and I asked her like what her intent was. Like, I think the exact question was, do you think you'll stay in Ibiza forever? And she gave me this look where it was like, why? I just met you 20 minutes ago. How are you going to ask me something about the rest of my life plans?
She's sitting in the middle seat. I'm sitting over on the right. And it was like a look. I haven't even thought about that. Like she's like, I haven't thought about this. Why is this guy in the middle seat asking me about this, you know?
And so it kind of highlighted the idea of deposits and receipts where it's like an ATM, right? If until you make a deposit into the bank account, you can't pull it out. That's like a little bit over
exaggerated. That's a great metaphor. Yeah, it's a good metaphor though.
But it definitely ties to my experience in New York because what I discovered was it's very important to approach personal and professional situations from a place of restraint until you can gauge whether individuals are receptive to your unique personality, right? So I'm the kind of person who wants to crack jokes and like make fun of people and myself. I'm the kind of person who wants to talk about deep and engaging topics and like dig pretty quickly. And I'm happy to have other people do that to me as well. It's not for everybody and it's not appropriate in every situation. So rather than just putting yourself out there immediately, it is helpful to hold back and learn how to gauge whether people are receptive to that and what their personal style is. And that helped me a lot after that experience that I had during the internship and early on during my full-time job. It helped me a lot in getting better at my job, getting better at, you know, managing my perception between my coworkers, between our clients, and projects just started to go better because I was able to manage myself better.
It's almost like you need to be able to contextualize before you, because I feel like there's no context before content.
Mm-hmm.
So your in an adequate place of, inadequate place of providing who you are as a person, which is contextualize yourself before you provide the content. So people would be able to like skew you, misconceptualize you and all that. So
definitely.
No, I could relate. It makes sense.
And I was lucky because I had some outlets. There were a lot of individuals that I was able to build some really cool relationships with while I was in New York. A lot of them were coworkers just by virtue of the fact that we spent, you know, 90% of our waking hours in the office. We ate breakfast, lunch, and dinner there. It was a lot. But a lot of people there had similar interests to me, whether it was personal or professional. A lot of them had similar life goals or situations. So mm-hmm. I was able to find some cool people that acted as like release valves. So while I had to approach other social situations or professional situations with a pretty high degree of restraint, mm-hmm. I could at least be my authentic self with those individuals. So I didn't feel cooped up. I didn't feel like pressure building to like let it out, you know? Mm-hmm.
So almost like a bridgeway question, but before we translate into how you departed that part of chapter of life to the mm-hmm. next chapter, which is your current chapter. So quick question. So I've recently been fascinated about this concept of depth versus width. So do you think in hindsight, because Aiden talked about this before, where hindsight is always human's greatest lesson, because in hindsight, you always learn. It's 2020, right? Mm-hmm. We can always learn in hindsight through time and experiments and whatever. So do you feel like if you were to adjust yourself, your persona, you tweak your EQ, circumstances, whatever the factors may be, your multitude of factors. So if you think with all those adjustments made, you think you're able to dig deeper into the depth? Because it sounds like with your outlets, you're able to really create some, foster some really, really deep, meaningful relationships mm-hmm. with some people
yep.
and trigger some others mm-hmm. and offend some others. So in terms of like depth versus width, how do you think that played out in terms of your, like in terms of like the lens of hindsight?
That's a really interesting question. Could I like paraphrase and see if I'm getting it right?
Yeah.
Are you saying that by learning how to have restraint,
this compromised learning experience,
did I actually learn how to have better relationships? Is that what you're saying?
No, it's more so of, you thought you had this profound, very meaningful learning experiences through this potentially adverse,
yep.
like hostile environment, right? Mm-hmm. And you said that because of your authentic gregarious self really affected how you connected with your peers and some of your bosses.
Yep.
And you're saying that in hindsight, by learning how to react and act in this restrained environment, you're able to extend horizontally, which mm-hmm. is width. But I'm saying in terms of the timeline, if that never happens, if you're really stuck to yourself, you're being your authentic self
okay.
all the way,
sure.
you think that would affect your depth?
Interesting question. I don't think so. I think in the situation that I was in, I had to adapt. If I continued to just be over the top, it would have gotten worse quickly. Yeah, I mean, I think it would have continued to rub some of my peers the wrong way. It would have continued to rub some of my colleagues and, I guess, higher-ups the wrong way. And so the relationship...
But wouldn't you also continue fostering some of your...
Yeah. So like, the relationships that I was going to develop, I developed. I think just by having a little bit of restraint in the first 5 minutes of a conversation doesn't stop you from developing deep and meaningful relationships. I don't think I missed out on too many opportunities to build good relationships or like have professional opportunities because I had 5% restraint before I allowed myself to be myself. But for the people that were going to be receptive to who I am, I think I was able to identify that pretty quickly and then I opened up. But by having that 5% restraint in the beginning, it made me much more amenable to people and like digestible mm-hmm. to the point where I could build relationships with people that may not love that extremely authentic mm-hmm. self.
And I think that's really representative of kind of corporate America in general, is sometimes it's almost better to have width than depth, especially in such a team dynamic. Like personally, when I was working around literally a table this size, you know, six people crowded around it, it's almost better to get along with everybody at like an 80% rather than have a 120% relationship with one specific person and have the other side of the table hate you. You know, mm-hmm. I think it's an unfortunate...
You have to play the game.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate... I don't know if it's a paradox or what you want to call it, but just, I guess, strategy is not that you can't get deep with certain people, but it's almost better to be... you know, liked.
Polarized?
Yeah. Not polarized. It's worse to be polarized in a team dynamic business situation because ultimately the goal of the team is to bring as much good team to the team as a whole. Definitely. And you can't do that if half the team isn't getting along. I'd rather have a 70% of everyone just hanging out. You can have the small chat around lunch and have a good time together. But I don't need some guy from work giving my, like, best man speech or something. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. It's just kind of the unfortunate. It's not unfortunate. I mean, it's the kind of just the way corporate America is, at least the way I'm seeing it.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. From a business perspective, having everybody gel and perhaps having a slightly suboptimal social experience is definitely better for a business. I think that's undeniable.
Mm-hmm.
But I just mean personally, the lesson that I took out of it and have applied to my personal life as well is just learning how to kind of like step back for a second, gauge a situation, and then act. And that's just part of like the overall subject of strategy that I took a real interest in while I was in New York. And some of it you read in books, some of it you just learn and kind of live through in order to gain those lessons. But I think it's a really interesting topic. While you're in high pressure situations, it forces you to learn about yourself and grow in ways that other situations might not force you to as quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So like necessity is like the mother of invention, I think is the popular quote.
Ooh, I like that.
Right?
Yeah, that's dope.
So when you're in a really high pressure situation where what you're doing just isn't working and you really want something to work out, you have to change. You have to adapt. And so, though it was painful,
mm-hmm.
I think it helped me become a better person. So,
are there any...
Peter Thiel said that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the co-founder of PayPal.
Yeah.
He paraphrased that. He didn't say it originally, but he talked about that.
Definitely.
Yeah, that's why he started saying like PayPal online banking was a necessity part of... That's why it came to invention.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, can we use that as a bridgeway to your next chapter of... why and how you departed from that lucrative chapter of your life into your current, more, I guess, smaller, you know, venue?
Sure. Yeah. So, like I said, my parents, when they kind of moved to this country from India, they were engineers. But after a little while, once they had a little bit of a base in terms of like some savings, paid off their house, etc., they were willing to take some risk. They started a few different small businesses. They raised my brother and I to be innovative and like always questioning things. And so, and also like we just grew up in the context of starting new business ventures. So I was lucky in that I had early exposure to taking business risk and building things on your own in terms of infrastructure and whatnot. So I never feared it. I always embraced it. That's why I was pretty happy and enthusiastic to start a student organization at Penn State. And so I took on a few initiatives at Bank of America very similarly, where you know I could have just focused on one job, but I tried to do a few extracurricular things within the company that enhanced the overall experience for everybody, kind of intrapreneurship, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I never really shied away from it, and I attribute a lot of that to my upbringing. In terms of moving from like a bigger venue to a smaller venue, it has certainly been a change. I don't think it was an intentional downsize. I don't think it was me saying I want to be at a smaller place compared to a bigger place. I think it was more, ever since I was a kid, I always wanted to build and be the captain of my own ship, right? I always had fun ideas, whether it was a real estate investment company, whether it was a marketing and branding company like what I'm doing now, whether it was starting my own consulting company. I always just wanted to know that my successes were by virtue of my merits and my hard work and my ability to be dynamic and work with people, but also do analytical work. I always wanted to be very well-rounded and use the fact that I am a little bit scatterbrained to my advantage so that I wasn't just siloed into doing one thing. I would have the ability to do a lot of tasks and wear a lot of hats and try to grow myself in that way such that I could run a successful small business or startup.
Sorry, so were there any, so to speak, trigger points that made you transition from iBanking to your entrepreneurship, or was it more like gradualism?
So I would say other than kind of like the other small entrepreneurial opportunities that I pursued kind of throughout my life, which I would say is gradual, right? When I was 17, nobody kind of even guided me towards doing this externship that I did and leading to a corporate internship while I was still in high school. That was just kind of like an entrepreneurial opportunity that I lunged at. When I was a freshman in college, I started my own financial consultancy. I didn't do like a corporate internship my freshman year. I built trading models using the Excel and VBA skills that I learned to build trading models for wealth advisors in my hometown, and I sold them. So I think starting little ventures, and then sophomore year, I started that student organization, the Microfinance Initiative. So I think throughout my life, it's been a gradual process to like try to build things and learn how to become an entrepreneur in whatever capacity I could. So that, to answer your question, that was like a gradual process. But in terms of transitioning away from a bank and into a startup, that was much more by virtue of after I had gotten the finance experience in a big city like New York at a big bank like Bank of America, doing a really intense task, I figured I had gotten the reputation, or rather just kind of like the tag of, you know, I can work hard and I can produce results. So if I want to be in corporate America, I think I've done enough to prove that I can be dynamic and I can be a good worker. Now, it's an interesting time to be 25 years old, which is but like already having a good foothold in corporate America, or at least having that tag of you're a hard worker, because before business school or graduate school or whatever the next opportunity I go on to, if there is one, I have this opportunity to take risk, try my own small business. If it works out, which I'm pretty sure it will, I'm bullish on myself, then like I can I can continue with it. Yeah. If it doesn't, then I have a lot of professional flexibility because I did that job and because I'm 25. So it just...
You have a cushion to fall back on if you wanted to.
Yeah. So if I decide, you know, my whole life I've been trying to do entrepreneurial things, but I'm doing it now and this is not what I expected it to be, then I've done the 2 years in banking. I can pivot back to corporate America. Or at least I like to think I can. Or I can go to business school or something like that. So now is the time, like, because I was raised by my parents who have kind of that serial entrepreneur background, they were supportive of it. I had a little bit of saving because I've been working since I was 14 years old. And so I just felt like now was the time to use some of my professional padding and take a risk.
So as you're putting your Wall Street days behind you and kind of moving on to the next chapter, what are some of the biggest things that you're going to take with you as lessons and or advice to give out to our listeners?
That's a good question. I mean, it's a common question, but when you're reflecting back on like a pretty lengthy and such a deep and life-changing experience, it's tough to pin down one thing. I think one of the biggest topics and trends that I take away from the past several years of my life is just the ability to think within frameworks. And that came in a few directions, or came from a few sources. So I mentioned this guy earlier. He is a good friend of mine. He sat next to me at the bank, and he grew up in a tough part of LA, East LA. The average
like Compton?
No, I don't know the exact town that he's from. He just said he was from East LA. And his parents were Chinese immigrants. They did not speak English. They did not go to university. And so they did manual labor jobs, didn't make too much money. The average income of his neighborhood wasn't very high. It was a really diverse school. A lot of kids, their parents were in a similar situation. They either, you know, immigrated here from East Asia or South America. And there were like gangs in the town and just not too many educational resources. Teachers weren't that great, etc. Mm-hmm. And he, I don't know, just had this work ethic put in him by his parents at a young age. And he also clearly naturally had it. It was a strong combination of both, to the point where he was a valedictorian of his high school. He was class president. He got a 2400 on his SATs. He applied to every Ivy League school and got into every one of them. He got into every kind of like excellent tier school, like the Stanfords of the world, the MITs of the world, got in as well. He didn't get a single rejection. He was on like a Rubik's Cube team and could do a Rubik's Cube in 30 seconds.
One hand.
And he was just a beast. He also was like a power lifter and could deadlift 450. Like, he was a beast.
Jesus.
Yeah.
He
was he a, Jesus? Was,
no. I mean, he was, to my knowledge, he's just a guy. Had a good set of friends. And so he chose to go to Yale and study political science. And while he was there, he was in a program called the Grand Strategy Program, where the main focus is on learning lessons from history of how the greatest minds thought about corporate strategy, statecraft, war strategy, etc., and just the idea of strategy itself. So the overarching idea of strategy itself is knowing very clearly what your resources are and very clearly what your goals are, and trying to create a plan of turning your resources into achieving those goals. It sounds very simple, but in practice, it becomes such a complicated affair that you can learn a lot about your own life, about how to succeed at work, about how to run a country, just by thinking about goals and resources. So this guy went to Yale, was part of this program, didn't have many connections in the industry because he had no family that was in it. He didn't network into it while he was in college because he was learning from the Secretary of Defense. He wasn't learning from bankers, right? He was not in the business school, etc. So he, on a whim one day, decided he wants to do finance. So he joined kind of like a middle tier bank for an internship. After the internship, networked his way into Bank of America, which is a pretty solid investment bank. After in Bank of America, he ended up at one of the largest private equity companies in the world. And from there, he's applying business and law school. And last I heard, I think he had gotten accepted into Yale Law School. So,
which is number one right now.
Which is number one in the world. And so he's just on this fast track. And every step along the way, him and I, because we built a really good relationship, we just re-strategize. Okay, for the next 2 years, what am I going to do? This is what I have. I have a degree. I have, you know, a high-functioning mind. And these are my goals. I want to get to this school. I want to get to this job. I want to become this kind of person. So we very clearly outlined these are the people that he knows. These are all of his resources. These are all of his goals. And then we make a plan of how to go forward. And then we do the same thing with me. And so I'm so grateful that I met this guy, because even though he didn't have very many resources in the beginning, he had a very clear understanding of grand strategy from a young age, where he built up he knew what his goals were. He knew he didn't have the resources to do it. And so he built them piece by piece, got the best grades, got the best test scores, got the scholarships, made it to the best school, made it to the best bank, made it to the best private equity company. And every step along the way, as he develops his goals more clearly based on the experiences that he's having and the conversations that he has, he figures out which resources that he needs in order to take that next. And so I think the biggest takeaway for me, and perhaps something that I like to just share with other people, is being very deliberate about framing the decisions that you make, and thinking about what are my goals, what am I passionate about, what do I want. I know that that is an entire subject in and of itself, but really thinking hard about what do I want, at least what do I think what I want, and then not harping on it too much, just coming up with a concept or a few bullet points of this is what I want, these are my goals, and then thinking really deeply about what are the resources that I need to get there. Right? Is it certifications? Is it education? Is it networking? Do I need to read more about a specific topic? Do I need to go somewhere? And really spending those hours in building out your resources. And being a good strategist means never overextending yourself. Never thinking, I have this goal. I don't have the resources, but I'm going to shoot for it. And if it doesn't work out, I'm going to quit. And it's going to have a severe effect. It's having a very balanced approach to, I know what my goals are. I know what I have, what I don't have, and what I just don't know, and spending the hours and working towards getting to it. So I think just exploring the topic of strategy in the framework of resources and goals is something that could help a lot of people, and it has certainly helped me over the past several years.
It's like what Bill Gates talked about, where Bill Gates talked about this point of where he says people overthink what they could achieve in a year and underthink what they could achieve in 10 years. So it's almost like have a macro vision, but don't oversweat about the macros. Just do your diligence, do your part on a macroly speaking to grant your grand scheme of the vision that your friends talked about, right?
Definitely.
So what Bill Gates talked about, you know, don't look at everything in a timeline of 10 years, but of course, like due diligence of every year to achieve that 10-year plan.
But I think even outside the 10-year plan, just with the resources and strategy approach, you could apply that to something as small as the day ahead. You know, it doesn't need to be this large vision of the future, but it could be, all right, what do I have this morning? What are my to-dos and how can I get to the vision of what I want my night to look like? You know, like I feel like, you know, if he studied that, he was in a program for corporate strategy that probably shows how you can apply that strategy to something as small as an hour and as long as a lifetime.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think there's something freeing about it, which is an amazing outcome of thinking in terms of grand strategy, mm-hmm. right? Where some people don't know how to organize the storm in their minds. And I know I was that way for the longest time, where I knew that I'm a passionate person. I know that I have all this pent-up energy and I feel like I have the tools to be successful at what I'm passionate about. I just needed to be guided. Not necessarily guided. I needed a format or a framework so that I could organize my thoughts, organize my passions, really think about what is it that I want? What is it that I have in my possession right now? What do I need to find out or build in order to get where I want? And once you map those things out, it's very freeing because you're extremely, it's very objective. You no longer have to think, oh, there are so many hurdles in my way. I don't know if I can do this. You have a map in front of you that says, this is what I want. This is what I need. This is what I need to find out because I just don't know it. And an action plan comes right out of it. It's like when you're in school and you do your homework. And so you can go party with your friends without stress. You've done the work. You know exactly what you need to do and what kind of latitudes you can afford yourself and what flexibility. You're so accountable and you're so prepared that you're free. You're free from the uncertainty of can I do this or how is it going to happen or will it ever happen. You now have a map that right in front of you says, this is what I want. This is what I need to do in order to get it. And there's something freeing about that.
Thank you, Nick, for being on our episode for the week.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for having me. It was a blast.
You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify every Monday at 7 a.m. Eastern Time. Follow us on Instagram at Discover More Podcast. And please share this with your friends and everyone that you know. Thanks for listening to another episode of Discover More, where we intend to discover more life through intentional dialogues. And we truly appreciate everyone who have made it until the end. Till next Monday.